Section 4. Different forms of the relative surplus population. The general law of capitalistic accumulation. The relative surplus population exists in every possible form. Every laborer belongs to it during the time when he is only partially employed or wholly unemployed. Not taking into account the great periodically recurring forms that the changing phases of the industrial cycle impress on it, now an acute form during the crisis, then again a chronic form during dull times, it has always three forms: the floating, the latent, the stagnant. In the centres of modern industry, factories, manufactures, ironworks, mines, etc., the labourers are sometimes repelled, sometimes attracted again in greater masses, the number of those employed increasing on the whole, although in a constantly decreasing proportion to the scale of production. Here the surplus population exists in the floating form. In the automatic factories, as in all the great workshops where machinery enters as a factor, or where only the modern division of labour is carried out, large numbers of boys are employed up to the age of maturity. When this term is once reached, only a very small number continue to find employment in the same branches of industry, whilst the majority are regularly discharged. This majority forms an element of the floating surplus population, growing with the extension of those branches of industry. Part of them emigrates, following, in fact, capital that has emigrated. One consequence is that the female population grows more rapidly than the male. Teste, England. That the natural increase of the number of labourers does not satisfy the requirements of the accumulation of capital, and yet all the time is in excess of them, is a contradiction inherent to the movement of capital itself. It wants larger numbers of youthful labourers, a smaller number of adults. The contradiction is not more glaring than that other one, that there is a complaint of the want of hands, while at the same time many thousands are out of work, because the division of labour chains them to a particular branch of industry. Footnote. Whilst during the last 6 months of 1866, 80,000 to 90,000 working people in London were thrown out of work, the factory report for that same half-year says, "It does not appear absolutely true to say that demand will always produce supply just at the moment when it is needed. It has not done so with labour, for much machinery has been idle last year for want of hands." Report of Inspector of Factories, 31st of October, 1866. End of footnote. The consumption of labour power by capital is, besides, so rapid that the labourer, halfway through his life, has already more or less completely lived himself out. He falls into the ranks of the supernumeraries, or is thrust down from a higher to a lower step in the scale. It is precisely among the workpeople of modern industry that we meet with the shortest duration of life. Dr. Lee, Medical Officer of Health for Manchester, stated that the average age at death of the Manchester upper middle class was 38 years, while the average age at death of the labouring class was 17. While at Liverpool, those figures were represented as 35 against 15. It thus appeared that the well-to-do classes had a lease of life which was more than double the value of that which fell to the lot of the less favoured citizens. Footnote. Opening address to the Sanitary Conference, Birmingham, January the 15th, 1875, by J. Chamberlain, Mayor of the town, now, 1883, President of the Board of Trade. End of footnote. In order to conform to these circumstances, the absolute increase of this section of the proletariat must take place under conditions that shall swell their numbers, although the individual elements are used up rapidly. Hence, rapid renewal of the generations of labourers. This law does not hold for the other classes of the population. This social need is met by early marriages, a necessary consequence of the conditions in which the labourers of modern industry live, and by the premium that the exploitation of children sets on their production. As soon as capitalist production takes possession of agriculture, and in proportion to the extent to which it does so, the demand for an agricultural labouring population falls absolutely, while the accumulation of the capital employed in agriculture advances without this repulsion being, as in non-agricultural industries, compensated by a greater attraction. Part of the agricultural population is therefore constantly on the point of passing over into an urban or manufacturing proletariat, and on the lookout for circumstances favourable to this transformation. Manufacture is used here in the sense of all non-agricultural industries. Footnote. 781 towns given in the census for 1861 for England and Wales contained 10,960,998 inhabitants, while the villages and country parishes contained 9,105,226. In 1851, 580 towns were distinguished, and the population in them and the surrounding country was nearly equal. But while in the subsequent 10 years the population in the villages and the country increased 500,000, the population in the 580 towns increased by 1.5 million, to 1,554,067. The increase of the population of the country parishes is 6.5%, and of the towns, 17.3%. The difference in the rates of increase is due to the migration from country to town. 3/4 of the total increase of population has taken place in the towns. Census, etc. End of footnote. The source of relative surplus population is thus constantly flowing, but the constant flow towards the town presupposes, in the country itself, a constant latent surplus population, the extent of which becomes evident only when its channels of outlet open to exceptional width. The agricultural labourer is therefore reduced to the minimum of wages, and always stands with one foot already in the swamp of pauperism. The third category of the relative surplus population, the stagnant, forms a part of the active labour army, but with extremely irregular employment. Hence it furnishes to capital an inexhaustible reservoir of disposable labour power. Its conditions of life sink below the average normal level of the working class. This makes it at once the broad basis of special branches of capitalist exploitation. It is characterized by maximum of working time and minimum of wages. We have learned to know its chief form under the rubric of domestic industry. It recruits itself constantly from the supernumerary forces of modern industry and agriculture, and specially from those decaying branches of industry where handicraft is yielding to manufacture, manufacture to machinery. Its extent grows as, with the extent and energy of accumulation, the creation of a surplus population advances. But it forms at the same time a self-reproducing and self-perpetuating element of the working class, taking a proportionally greater part in the general increase of that class than the other elements. In fact, not only the number of births and deaths, but the absolute size of the families stand in inverse proportion to the height of wages, and therefore to the amount of means of subsistence of which the different categories of labourers dispose. This law of capitalistic society would sound absurd to savages, or even civilised colonists. It calls to mind the boundless reproduction of animals individually weak and constantly hunted down. Footnote. Poverty seems favourable to generation. A. Smith. This is even a specially wise arrangement of God, according to the gallant and witty Abbe Galliani. God ordains that men who carry on trades of primary utility are born in abundance. Galliani. Misery up to the extreme point of famine and pestilence, instead of checking, tends to increase population. S. Lang, National Distress, 1844. After Lang has illustrated this by statistics, he continues, "If the people were all in easy circumstances, the world would soon be depopulated." End of footnote. The lowest sediment of the relative surplus population finally dwells in the sphere of pauperism. Exclusive of vagabonds, criminals, prostitutes, in a word, the dangerous classes, this layer of society consists of three categories. First, those able to work. One need only glance superficially at the statistics of English pauperism to find that the quantity of paupers increases with every crisis, and diminishes with every revival of trade. Second, orphans and pauper children. These are candidates for the Industrial Reserve Army, and are in times of great prosperity, as 1860, for example, speedily and in large numbers enrolled in the active army of labourers. Third, the demoralised and ragged, and those unable to work, chiefly people who succumb to their incapacity for adaptation due to the division of labour, people who have passed the normal age of the labourer, the victims of industry, whose number increases with the increase of dangerous machinery, of mines, chemical works, etc., the mutilated, the sickly, the widows, etc. Pauperism is the hospital of the active labour army and the dead weight of the industrial reserve army. Its production is included in that of the relative surplus population, its necessity in theirs. Along with the surplus population, pauperism forms a condition of capitalist production and of the capitalist development of wealth. It enters into the faux frais of capitalist production. But capital knows how to throw these, for the most part, from its own shoulders, onto those of the working class and the lower middle class. The greater the social wealth, the functioning capital, the extent and energy of its growth, and therefore also the absolute mass of the proletariat and the productiveness of its labour, the greater is the Industrial Reserve Army. The same causes which develop the expansive power of capital develop also the labour power at its disposal. The relative mass of the Industrial Reserve Army increases, therefore, with the potential energy of wealth. But the greater this reserve army in proportion to the active labour army, the greater is the mass of a consolidated surplus population, whose misery is in inverse ratio to its torment of labour. The more extensive, finally, the Lazarus layers of the working class and the industrial reserve army, the greater is official pauperism. This is the absolute general law of capitalist accumulation. Like all other laws, it is modified in its working by many circumstances, the analysis of which does not concern us here. The folly is now patent of the economic wisdom that preaches to the labourers the accommodation of their number to the requirements of capital. The mechanism of capitalist production and accumulation constantly effects this adjustment. The first word of this adaptation is the creation of a relative surplus population, or industrial reserve army. Its last word is the misery of constantly extending strata of the active army of labour and the dead weight of pauperism. The law by which a constantly increasing quantity of means of production, thanks to the advance in the productiveness of social labour, may be set in movement by a progressively diminishing expenditure of human power. This law, in a capitalist society, where the labourer does not employ the means of production but the means of production employ the labourer, undergoes a complete inversion, and is expressed thus. The higher the productiveness of labour, the greater is the pressure of the labourers on the means of employment, the more precarious, therefore, becomes their condition of existence, viz., the sale of their own labour power for the increasing of another's wealth, or for the self-expansion of capital. The fact that the means of production and the productiveness of labour increase more rapidly than the productive population expresses itself, therefore, capitalistically, in the inverse form that the labouring population always increases more rapidly than the conditions under which capital can employ this increase for its own self-expansion. We saw in Part 4, when analysing the production of relative surplus value, within the capitalist system, all methods for raising the social productiveness of labour are brought about at the cost of the individual labourer. All means for the development of production transform themselves into means of domination over and exploitation of the producers. They mutilate the labourer into a fragment of a man, degrade him to the level of an appendage of a machine, destroy every remnant of charm in his work, and turn it into a hated toil. They estrange from him the intellectual potentialities of the labour process in the same proportion as science is incorporated in it as an independent power. They distort the conditions under which he works, subject him during the labour process to a despotism the more hateful for its meanness. They transform his lifetime into working time, and drag his wife and child beneath the wheels of the juggernaut of capital. But all methods for the production of surplus value are at the same time methods of accumulation, and every extension of accumulation becomes again a means for the development of those methods. It follows, therefore, that in proportion as capital accumulates, the lot of the labourer, be his payment high or low, must grow worse. The law, finally, that always equilibrates the relative surplus population or industrial reserve army to the extent and energy of accumulation, this law rivets the labourer to capital more firmly than the wedges of Vulcan did Prometheus to the rock. It establishes an accumulation of misery corresponding with accumulation of capital. Accumulation of wealth at one pole is therefore at the same time accumulation of misery, agony of toil, slavery, ignorance, brutality, mental degradation at the opposite pole, that is, on the side of the class that produces its own product in the form of capital. Footnote. From day to day it thus becomes clearer that the production relations in which the bourgeoisie moves have not a simple uniform character, but a dual character, that in the self-same relations in which wealth is produced, poverty is produced also, that in the self-same relations in which there is a development of productive forces, there is also a force producing repression, that there relations produce bourgeois wealth, that is, the wealth of the bourgeois class, only by continually annihilating the wealth of the individual members of this class, and by producing an ever-growing proletariat. Karl Marx, Misère de la Philosophie. End of footnote. This antagonistic character of capitalistic accumulation is enunciated in various forms by political economists, although by them it is confounded with phenomena, certainly to some extent analogous, but nevertheless essentially distinct, and belonging to pre-capitalistic modes of production. The Venetian monk Orthez, one of the great economic writers of the 18th century, regards the antagonism of capitalist production as a general natural law of social wealth. In the economy of a nation, advantages and evils always balance one another. The abundance of wealth with some people is always equal to the want of it with others. The great riches of a small number are always accompanied by the absolute privation of the first necessaries of life for many others. The wealth of a nation corresponds with its population, and its misery corresponds with its wealth. Diligence in some compels idleness in others. The poor and idle are a necessary consequence of the rich and active, etc. Footnote. G. Orthez, Delia Economia Nazionale Libri Sei, 1777, in Custodi Parte Moderna. Orthez says, "Instead of projecting useless systems for achieving the happiness of people, I shall limit myself to investigating the reasons for their unhappiness." End of footnote. In a thoroughly brutal way, about 10 years after Orthez, the Church of England parson Townsend glorified misery as a necessary condition of wealth. "Legal constraint to labour is attended with too much trouble, violence, and noise, whereas hunger is not only a peaceable, silent, unremitted pressure, but as the most natural motive to industry and labour, it calls forth the most powerful exertions. Everything, therefore, depends upon making hunger permanent among the working class, and for this, according to Townsend, the principle of population, especially active among the poor, provides. It seems to be a law of nature that the poor should be to a certain degree improvident, that is, so improvident as to be born without a silver spoon in the mouth. That there may always be some to fulfil the most servile, the most sordid, and the most ignoble offices in the community. The stock of human happiness is thereby much increased, whilst the more delicate are not only relieved from drudgery, but are left at liberty without interruption to pursue those callings which are suited to their various dispositions. It, the poor law, tends to destroy the harmony and beauty, the symmetry and order of that system which God and nature have established in the world." Footnote. A dissertation on the poor laws by a well-wisher of mankind, the Reverend J. Townsend, 1786, republished London, 1817. This delicate parson, from whose work just quoted, as well as from his journey through Spain, Malthus often copies whole pages, himself borrowed the greater part of his doctrine from Sir James Stuart, whom he, however, alters in the borrowing. For example, when Stuart says, "Here in slavery was a forcible method of making mankind diligent, for the non-workers, men were then forced to work, that is, to work gratis for others, because they were slaves of others. Men are now forced to work, that is, to work gratis for non-workers, because they are the slaves of their necessities." He does not thence conclude, like the fat holder of benefices, that the wage labourer must always go fasting. He wishes, on the contrary, to increase their wants and to make the increasing number of their wants a stimulus to their labour for the more delicate. End of footnote. If the Venetian monk found, in the fatal destiny that makes misery eternal, the raison d'être of Christian charity, celibacy, monasteries, and holy houses, the Protestant prebendary finds in it a pretext for condemning the laws in virtue of which the poor possessed a right to a miserable public relief. The progress of social wealth, says Storch, begets this useful class of society, which performs the most wearisome, the vilest, the most disgusting functions, which takes, in a word, on its shoulders all that is disagreeable and servile in life, and procures thus, for other classes, leisure, serenity of mind, and conventional, c'est bon, dignity of character. Storch asks himself, in what then really consists the progress of this capitalistic civilization, with its misery and its degradation of the masses, as compared with barbarism? He finds but one answer: security. Thanks to the advance of industry and science, says Sismondi, every labourer can produce every day much more than his consumption requires. But at the same time, whilst his labour produces wealth, that wealth would, were he called on to consume it himself, make him less fit for labour. According to him, men, that is, non-workers, would probably prefer to do without all artistic perfection and all the enjoyments that manufacturers procure for us, if it were necessary that all should buy them by constant toil like that of the labourer. Exertion today is separated from its recompense. It is not the same man that first works and then reposes, but it is because the one works that the other rests. The indefinite multiplication of the productive powers of labour can then only have for result the increase of luxury and enjoyment of the idle rich. Finally, Destutt de Tracy, the fish-blooded bourgeois doctrinaire, blurts out brutally, "In poor nations the people are comfortable, in rich nations they are generally poor."